This radio program was originally broadcast on the 20th of June 2020 and features guest John Ashley. Get a host of bonus features like this and full mixes as podcasts by signing up as a supporter at patreon.com/centuriesofsound.
Hello and welcome to Centuries of Sound, the show where we use archive recordings to take a deep dive into the prehistory of sound. My name is James Errington. I run the website centuriesofsound.com, where I'm making a mix for every year recorded sound from 1853 to the present day. And today I'm joined by John Ashlin.
Hello there.
John is a friend from China. Are you Chinese, John?
I'm not, but I've spent a lot of time there.
I used to live in China for about 10 years and John's done about 14 now, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not counting though anymore.
not counting, but right now you're in the UK.
That's right, yeah.
So what we've just heard there is a very atmospheric klezmer recording, instrumental. What did you make of that then?
Well, this is just my kind of music. I just imagine myself, I'm on the Silk Road, on the caravan. I'm maybe going east or west, it doesn't really matter, I'm just going somewhere, and I'm listening to this kind of music, so I could listen to this over and over again. It's really evocative, and I love that kind of eastern vibe, and I'm fascinated to know more about the instrument.
So this is a cymbalom. I hadn't heard of cymbaloms before, but it's a dulcimer is a kind of cymbalom. Have you heard of a dulcimer?
Not really, no, I'm sorry.
So if you take a stringed instrument like a guitar, and you have a guitar and you let it down on its back, and then you take away the neck of the guitar, and you add a lot more strings, and you have a few different bridges in there.
I see.
You've got yourself a cymbalom.
Oh, right.
Like a box with, oh, it's kind of, or maybe it's like a piano that's had all the bits taken off.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
And you're just plucking the strings.
I see.
In like a grand piano, inside. It's that kind of thing. But yeah, beautiful instrumental there. That's, I'd say, klezmer music, which is the traditional music of the Jewish community of Eastern Europe and in general, kind of Eastern European. This is taken from the year 1916, which is the year we're looking at today. You've heard my mix for 1916. So what do you make of the music of 1916 in general? Was it what you expected?
Yeah, I mean, there were what I would sort of term like bandstand music, sort of the traditional kinds of music. That, you know, there were some of the tracks that passed me by, but I particularly liked, you know, there were some of these kinds of tracks that I really enjoyed. And there were some interesting tracks with some beautiful vocals, male and female. There were some novelty tracks in there that were quite interesting. And also, just sort of one sort of thing that I did notice was percussion. They don't seem to have a grip on percussion yet, or kind of like getting the sound levels right on percussion on some of the tracks. You know, they're kind of sometimes a little bit, they need to be a little bit more in the background, some of them. But so, yeah, I just thought, you know, because you don't sort of have drum kits and this kind of thing. So I found that sort of interesting as well. But I'd be looking forward to going through the tracks, you know, step by step, really.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point, because at this stage, I don't know how you would picture a recording studio, but we don't have recording studios at this point, really. The reason for that, well, we don't have multi-track recording, of course. That doesn't come until much later, not really until the 60s. It becomes a common thing. But the important thing here is that we're in the acoustic era still. The acoustic era is, so you imagine kind of an old gramophone with a big horn. It's one of those they're recording into. So they're not recording into a microphone. It's the actual sound waves going down a big brass horn, pushing the stylus into the wax to produce it. So it's very hard to manage things at all. You know, you can imagine the tricks they have to go to record any of this music. They're pushing, they've got wheels on chairs and pushing soloists closer to the to the horn. And they're putting they're taking away most of the drum kit because it'll be too loud, and putting it right the way at the back of the hall. And they've got, lots of instruments they say won't record well at all, so they haven't really bothered with them. They'll cut down an orchestra of 30 or 40 down to like 6 or 7 people, and cut out bits they think will distort the recording, because it's very easy to make that needle skip. So it's a miracle that we have anything recorded before 1925, really, when the microphone came in. But we do, and we have all of this kind of music, which that's why people don't listen to it so much, I'd say. It's it's that acoustic recording technology rather than the electrical recording technology that came in with the microphone in like 25.
Interested also, because obviously listening to some of, you know, from some of your previous shows from, you know, a lot earlier, several decades previously, the recordings were sort of, they were kind of novelty. There wasn't really a lot of obviously there wasn't like a record industry at that time. How about at this time now, in terms of what is the recording industry like? Who's the audience? Who are the audience for these recordings and that kind of thing?
Well, that's a good point. There's it's still a novelty thing to have in your house, but more and more it's a device that lots of people have. So we're kind of moving from the days where it's just a few rich people have it as like a party trick, and you know, and we're moving more towards the day when more and more people can have it. But they're trying to sell it as like an improving thing. So lots of the things being sold up, the cylinders and discs, are opera, because they think opera is proper music. And the recording industry is all based in New York, and it's a number of bands who are also based in New York, and artists are recording. That doesn't mean they're the best or most famous. It's just they're the ones who are in the business of recording. So it's a bit of a strange picture we get. The kind of music that's popular in 1916, this is the right at the tail end of the ragtime era. When people think of ragtime, the first name they probably think of is Scott Joplin, I'd say. Let's hear some Scott Joplin. He never made a disc or cylinder in his lifetime. So he's the king of ragtime, wrote like Maple Leaf Rag and The Entertainer and all those. If you think of a ragtime song on the piano, he most likely wrote it. But yeah, he didn't record anything in his lifetime. So what we have here is a piano roll that he recorded towards the end of his life. He was dying of syphilis at this point. So it was a recording piano roll. And if you have a listen to some of the other piano rolls he made this year, they are awful, especially Maple Leaf Rag. It sounds kind of discordant and out of tune. The rhythm's all wrong, it's out of tune. And, you know, he's got the shakes because he's dying of syphilis. Wow. So it's quite sad. But this one, I believe, has been corrected by somebody or other after he died. So it doesn't sound terrible. But it's not, like I say, not a recording, it's a piano roll that's been put through a player piano recently, so we can hear what he sounds like. Shall we hear Scott Joplin then? This is Magnetic Rag. Thank you. So that was Scott Joplin with Magnetic Rag, a piano roll from the year 1916. I don't know how much Scott Joplin you're familiar with.
Very little, I'm afraid, yeah. I mean, the name obviously is, you know, obviously I'm aware of the name, but I'm not really aware of his oeuvre.
Yeah, that's all right. He's a very important, like 20 years, 15 years, 10 years before this. He's on his the final years of his life at this point. And ragtime has moved on quite a bit. So I think that sound is what you probably associate with ragtime. Is that right? But actually, what ragtime has moved on to, it's quite different. And we kind of think of it as a step towards jazz, but it's a lot more complicated than that. It does get quite complex on its own without moving towards jazz at all, really, in a sense. So this is a rag by a guy called Wilbur Sweatman, who would be one of the founding fathers of jazz a bit later. And he wrote this song, Down Home Rag. And we've heard this previously performed by James Reese Europe and his Society Orchestra a couple of episodes ago. But this is the man himself playing it. And then we're going to have a listen to also a version of the song by The Versatile Four, who are former members of James Reese Europe Society Orchestra, who've kind of branched out on their own. So that a smaller group who can tour rather than a whole orchestra. So without more description, let's hear what ragtime has turned into by the year 1960.
That's incredible. I mean, just it almost sounds like the end of some like magnus opus of some late like Beatles album. I don't know. But
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And the syncopations and just like they're just something different's happening there, like to the previous tracks.
Yeah, it's a glorious racket. Is how I originally described it. It's like they're going wild. They've played this song so many times, and it's like in front of an audience dancing the foxtrot at the end of the night, you know, and like winding up to get faster and faster and faster. What you might lack there that you find in jazz, even kind of early jazz, is like blue notes, is what we describe, like a kind of swerving, like a smearing of notes that get kind of going up or down. But you can kind of hear behind that wildness, there's still like a marching band somewhere there. I don't know, maybe on that one you can't really hear that, but let's hear one which you certainly can hear that. This is Eugene Jaudas' National Promenade Band. Eugene Jaudas, it's like the people who are getting big with their bands at this point, they're going to be swept away next year, like 1917.
It's like when punk came, right? Prog rock's out.
Yeah. It's like beginning rock and roll or punk or something, when all the old guy's not relevant anymore, and like Eugene Jaudas, he's not going to keep up with the new times at all. He tries, but he's not. And people don't really take an interest in stuff pre-jazz. So
that's a shame.
You can find nothing about him on the internet, basically, this guy, even though he's one of the biggest band leads at the time. And here he's playing a kind of bridge song that was being played before jazz and was one of the kind of jazz standards, as it will be. But it's interesting, it's around before jazz, you know. It's called Memphis Blues. I don't know if you'll recognize it, but yeah, let's have a listen to Eugene Jaudas playing Memphis Blues.
Listening to that, actually, there's a few bars in that that remind me of like the Mungo Jerry track, you know, in the summertime, with it, there's a little break there or whatever.
I know what you mean. Yeah, I think it's a musicianly trick which probably has a name that I don't know.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. So that's also I would say ragtime music, if I just to say what it was, and at the later developed stages of ragtime music. The song itself, it's by W.C. Handy, who's the big composer of the early jazz age, the father of the blues, he was also called. It was originally a campaign song for a mayoral candidate in Memphis, Tennessee. It was being performed at his rallies. That's the idea behind it. It's performed by loads of people over the years. And you might notice the name. It's called Memphis Blues. So yes, is this an example of the blues?
Well, there's a couple of tracks in the mix that refer to the blues and also like referring to jazz, but they're not actually jazz, you know.
We'll get to the jazz bit later.
Yes, for sure.
The blues one, I think, is interesting because it's there's a song called Just the Blues from 10 years before this, and quite a few songs called Something Blues, and blues won't be the name of a genre by itself until 1920. Let's hear another blues song, which is also a ragtime song. This is St. Louis Blues. This is a big hit, and it's going to be covered by quite a lot of other artists. It's maybe W.C. Handy's biggest hit. Let's have a listen to St. Louis Blues.
Seeing as the last song was a campaign song, I'm just hoping that things can only get better with this one. So,
you weren't a fan of Eugene Jaldas too much. Let's see what you think of Prince's band.
Okay.
Prince's band are okay. They are a record company executive, and he's the cousin of two U.S. presidents as well.
Okay,
Mr. Prince. So he's a man of society, leading an orchestra here. He's not a jazz musician from New Orleans, that's for sure.
Okay.
So is Prince's band with St. Louis Blues.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Prince's band with the St. Louis Blues. Was that familiar to you at all? I guess it maybe it was.
Yeah, so I'd be interested to find out more about this for sure.
It's composed by W.C. Handy again. W.C. Handy is that kind of fairly rare thing, you know, a black songwriter working in like the white world of Tin Pan Alley, and you know, well educated, and like he had his chops worked out with, you know, music school, that kind of thing. He knew very much about how music worked. It's got the kind of 12 bar blues form. So that means it ends with the, like, with, if you've got the lyrics there,
yes,
they repeat the first two lines, and that kind of thing. It's been called the jazz man's Hamlet, because it's been covered by like Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Bessie Smith, Count Basie, wow, Glenn Miller. You know, everyone's done a version of the St. Louis Blues. You could do like an amazing thing through the years, but it's pre-jazz. It's the interesting thing there.
Yeah, no, I could just feel that. You just sort of feel so many echoes of other stuff going on in there, you know, and I could still pick out a sort of bluesy element to it. Obviously, there's still a lot of difference, but you could kind of, yeah, the structurally or that kind of thing, that there was something there.
I don't know, if you ask people what does blues music sound like, I think they're either going to talk about like 60s electric blues, or they're going to go back to like 30s, like Robert Johnson, like some guy just playing his guitar kind of blues. But it's been around a lot longer than that, and it's kind of hard to nail it down to what it actually is. And when we actually come to blues recordings in a few years' time, it's going to be female singers only. Oh. It's going to be the big thing that does it. Let's have one more. I was going to say another W.C. Handy song, but this is... he published a version of it, but it seems to be a traditional song with different lyrics put to it. So I don't know if W.C. Handy can really claim credit for it. But anyway, it's called Hesitating Blues, and this one's got some lyrics to it. It's being sung by Arthur Collins, who we've heard a lot of. I've called him the Edwardian Elvis.
Interesting.
Because he's the guy who when he comes out of like minstrel shows, and he's, you know, all of the unfortunateness related to that. You know, he's doing an impression. He's a white man doing an impression of a black man singing, which is kind of distasteful to start with. But he uses that in a better way to some of the other people doing the same thing. And it's him who ends up doing the recorded version of lots of these songs. And we're going to come back to him later as well. So this is two versions of Hesitating Blues. The first is with Arthur Collins, and the second is Prince's Orchestra.
Okay.
Hello, Central, what's the matter with this life? I want to talk to that highbrow of mine. Tell me how long will I have to wait? Please give me 298. Why does you hesitate? What you say can't come to my throne. I stole last night, blew the wires all down. Tell me how long will I have to wait? I want to tell me now, why does you hesitate? Procrastination is the thief of time. So all the wise I'll say, once it's in time, may say nine, tomorrow's not today. And if you put off, somebody's bound to lose. I see he'd be mine, and I'd be feeling gay. Left alone to grieve and pine, my best friend's gone away. Gonna let me the hesitating blues.
So this kind of music, so this is going to be really big in sort of vaudeville and that kind of stuff, this kind of music, or
yeah, I think it's like that. It's the general kind of pop music of America at this time. What do you make of Arthur Collins, his voice there?
What do I think of it? I don't know really. I don't know.
Yeah, not a fan, I guess.
Yeah.
That's all right. I think I've got kind of Stockholm Syndrome with Arthur Collins.
Is that right?
Put together a compilation of his works. Because I don't know, if you hear the other singers, he is better. This show is the final show he'll appear on, so give him a send-off. He's been appearing in our show since...
He's
1898.
Wow. So he would be also like as performing as a black man in this song, essentially.
That's his whole style. That's the whole way he's set up. Yeah. His whole thing is that kind of imitation.
Mm.
But I think he's like Al Jolson, who's kind of on the up at this point as well. He kind of, I don't know if you can say he transcends it. That may be going way too far, but it's his own character that you're hearing, not just that at this point.
I see. So he just plays one character. He's been playing one character, or his character's been evolving, or he plays kind of multiple characters. So.
That's the style of this time. And there's a genre name that I don't want to repeat, because even the genre name is kind of an offensive slur. Mm. I think at this point he called himself the king of the ragtime singers.
Centuries of Sound on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Let's go on from songs called Something Blues by W.C. Handy, because we've heard like three of those now.
Yeah.
This is a song that sounds like, I don't know, almost identical to the first like official blues recordings in 1920. But it's not considered the first blues recording. Let's have a listen to it first. So this is Marion Harris with I Ain't Got Nobody.
There's a saying going all around this town, and I'm beginning to think it's true. It's awfully hard to love someone when they don't care about you. Just as good as any in this town. But now I'm sad.
You're listening to Centuries of Sound on Cambridge 105 Radio, and we've just heard I Ain't Got Nobody by Marion Harris from the year 1916. Now, was that a familiar song to you? I think
it's, well, again, it's a, you know, it's this just feeling a lot more, you know, bluesy now, and it just, it's really interesting. You know, I didn't realize this, the early blues were predominantly, like, as you were saying, female singers, you know, because I would associate it with male singers. And then obviously we have, you know, a small orchestra there that's supporting the singer. But obviously if you replace that in the future with the guitars and stuff, then, you know, you can see where it's come from. But again, obviously it's the theme, the lyrics, the themes of obviously, you know, love lost and stuff. So it's really starting to emerge here, yeah.
Yeah, you've got those ingredients, kind of songs about being like sad for some reason. And then you've got like a soulful vocal going on, and you've got it being called something blues quite often, and you've got a jazz backing is what's going to come along a bit later. But her vocal here is quite typical of what we'll hear on the first kind of like classical early blues recordings from 1920, 21, 22. But the interesting thing here is Marion Harris herself, because Marion Harris doesn't count as a blues singer because, she's a slight white woman singing a vaudeville song, basically, is what this comes down to. Even though this vaudeville song is bluesy and has, like, blues kind of tropes in it, and it will be, like, taken on as a blues song in the 1920s, and it is written by a black songwriter, Spencer Williams. It's still performed by like a white woman in the 1910s, so it doesn't work out as being a blues song for that reason, which seems kind of arbitrary and silly, but that's how it goes, I'm afraid.
I see.
And
that's just due to the nature of the recording industry, you know. And
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but what's going to happen in 1920 is there's going to be one song called Crazy Blues by Mamie Smith, which really takes off hugely, and they'll start setting up imprints and record labels for like a black audience, and the first thing they think they want is songs that sound just like that. So they get like a huge amount of those going in like the early years of 1920s. Just from that one record. And Marion Harris does join in with that. She does become like a blues singer in the 1920s, and she dies fairly young, in her early 50s. She started smoking in bed in the hotel, and she burned down the hotel with herself inside it.
Well, we've all been there, James, so
yeah. Enough of the music for now. Let's have a look what's going on in the world in 1916. What kind of things going on in the world in 1916 then?
Well, I was just thinking there, I was just listening to that song and, you know, thinking about the blues, and then I'm just thinking over to the trenches on the Western Front and the Eastern Front, and just this juxtaposition.
It's a sad place, yeah. But I don't think they'd be into the blues in the trenches particularly.
No.
I'd say.
But yeah.
Because we are in the middle of the First World War, of course, which is not to be forgotten, and it's a grim year all round. It's 1916. There's lots of bad stuff going on, isn't there? As far as the war goes.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're looking at, you know, the ideas of it all being over by Christmas. Those sort of daydreams are definitely over now. We're into sort of 1916, and we're just talking about like carnage on an unimaginable scale. I mean, you're talking about the Somme, 30,000 people dying in a single day. I mean, obviously, we're in an extremely awful period at the moment, and we're talking about, you know, in a single day, the amount of people that have died of COVID, obviously, in the last few months. I mean, the numbers are just extraordinary.
The Somme is like the whole second half of 1916, isn't it? It's like, yeah, a gigantic battle with more than a million dead. Yeah, that's insane.
So we've got that, and then we've got obviously naval battles, and we've got the war is spreading out into the Middle East and into Africa as well, and then we've got the rise of technology, obviously more advanced aircraft, and also gas is being used.
Yeah, that was deployed quite a lot at the Somme, wasn't it?
Mm.
Gallipoli, is Gallipoli 1916 as well, or is that 1915?
I'm not sure about 1916, but I do know just to look for a little bit of family history in terms of my the sort of great, well, in inverted commas, sort of naval confrontation was the Battle of Jutland. So that's just off the coast of Denmark. So this was like the sort of largest configuration. So you've got the Imperial German fleet, you've got the British fleet. So this is the sort of largest sort of standoff between the largest amount of battleships. You're talking about dozens of these vast sort of battleships and hundreds of ships facing off and engaging over a couple of days. And in the end, it was a sort of a bit inconclusive about who won in the end. But my actual great grandfather was actually at the Battle of Jutland, and he was on board one of these ships, and one of the British ships was sunk. And so during this battle, you can't imagine just the noise and the shell fire. Him and a couple of other sailors, they actually rowed out on a rowboat whilst the actual battle was going on, and to pick up survivors from the ship. So under the cover of fire, yeah. And so I've got a little bit of family history related to that massive naval battle.
Yeah, it's the only naval battle of the only proper naval battle of the war, isn't it?
One of these big standoffs, like battleship standoffs. I mean, obviously you've got all of the U-boat activity, and there's obviously the huge sort of convoys going to America to bring supplies back to keep, you know, Britain fed. But in terms of like a sort of big sort of naval battle engagement, that was the one, really. And then after that, really, you're talking about, that was the last sort of big battleship engagement. And then after that, soon after, you're obviously, aircraft carriers get invented, and then naval warfare changes, really. So,
end of an era, exactly, very much so.
For
yeah.
sure.
America, of course, not in the war in 1916, still not in the war. And they have Woodrow Wilson is the president. Is that right this time?
Yes.
Is that him? Yeah. And I think he has an election in 1916, doesn't he?
Yes. So, I mean, I think, again, so you've got, so obviously America's not in the war. There's the carnage that's going on in Europe. America doesn't, America doesn't want to get involved in these sort of European conflicts. So America's having an election. Obviously, they're enjoying the beginnings of the blues music as well. But then Woodrow Wilson would then become a really important player towards the end of the First World War. Obviously, America comes in and helps shift the balance on the Western Front. And obviously, the Allies finally defeat Germany and Austria-Hungary. But he was a very, really vital leader at the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War to decide, how are we going to punish Germany? How are we going to carve up these former empires? How are we going to create a stable peace? So he was very instrumental in setting up the League of Nations, which would become the United Nations. And also he was very much supportive of... he certainly wasn't a fan of these vast European colonies. So he was also very much focused on trying to support those territories that wanted to become independent. He felt that they should have the right to self-determination. So sort of Wilson was an important player, because obviously America was now the emerging superpower, and it was obviously supporting decolonization, and that would come at the end of the First World War. So him winning that election in that year probably was very important.
I mean, he ran on the slogan of he kept us out of the war, didn't he? On that election, which is interesting, because he would join the war
next year.
I think weeks after his inauguration, he joined the war.
Yeah.
But you had Theodore Roosevelt standing for the Progressive Party in the selection as well, and he was banging the war drum. He was the one banging the war drum, but split the vote and kept Woodrow Wilson in there.
Yes.
And it was Charles Hughes is the Republican who took the Northwest, and that's about it, really.
It's a very waspish name, that, isn't it? very waspish name, Charles Hughes.
Charles Evans Hughes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think...
A bit Welsh.
Yeah, no. But I was thinking, like, just looking at it more broadly, you know, this sort of 1916, really, this was... what you're talking about here, this death on an industrial scale. I mean, it is industrial slaughter. Gas, you know, using the latest scientific inventions to just kill more and more people. Like I say, this was sort of really for Europe and sort of Western countries, really. I think the First World War was the sort of death of that Enlightenment idea that, you know, through science and progress, you know, life will get better and better. That actually science and progress, in inverted commas, can also bring awful destruction. And obviously, that would happen again in the Second World War, but I think it certainly changed, and it was a shift in perhaps the beginning, sort of the beginning of the end of modernism and in the Enlightenment ideas, and maybe going on to then sort of postmodernism later. So I think that was important. And then obviously this theme of colonization, the end of colonialism, these big empires, the Ottoman Empire will soon collapse, the Austro-Hungarian Empire will soon collapse. And also you have the murmurings of the British Empire perhaps will be collapsing in the future, because you have the Easter Rising, obviously, in Ireland.
Oh, yeah, that's 1916 as well. Yeah, lots of stuff going on. I think, it is kind of a pivotal year in a sense, isn't it? In Austria, what's his name, dies.
I think it's Franz Joseph.
Franz Joseph Austria, yeah. Aged 86 after a reign of 68 years.
Yes.
Which is that's a long time. That is a very long time to be in charge of a big country like that.
So he was kind of like, obviously, their kind of Queen Victoria, you know. He'd been there from sort of early in the 19th century, and he'd sort of led this vast sort of empire, you know, this Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Habsburgs, who'd been around for, you know, for 1,000 years, really, as an important family in Europe. And he was the sort of this last great sort of, in inverted commas again, emperor of a big sort of European colony that would be gone in a couple of years' time. And obviously, because of his, was it his son or his cousin who was obviously shot in Sarajevo? That's how the whole First World War started. So
Franz Joseph of Austria is succeeded by his grand nephew, Charles the First, or Karl the First, Charles Karl. That's the same thing. Should we have a listen to Karl of Austria? He's making a speech on a disc.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on his accession, he's making a speech.
That's clip. Yeah, no, because so, I heard a speech, and I wasn't sure what that was. So yeah, okay, fantastic. Yeah.
Right, so yeah, this is Karl the First of Austria.
Wiederhole, meine Herren, was ich seit Jahren vertreten habe. Es wäre ein Glück für ganz Europa, wenn wir schnellstens einen Frieden der Verständigung haben können. Für die Verteidigung unseres Landes, für die Verteidigung von Heim und Heer, wird und muss das Volk eintreten. Von der Führung des Krieges für irgendwelche Vergewaltigungsziele will unser Volk nicht wissen.
Okay, so that's Karl the First of Austria making a speech on his accession. So for his long and glorious reign as the leader of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which would last until 1918, the end of the war, of course. So not that long.
So maybe he's just saying we're all doomed in German. I don't know.
Maybe that's what he's saying. Do you speak any German?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I'm sorry.
No, I don't either. Well, not enough to understand that, definitely. So the monarchy was abolished in 1918. So I got 2 years in charge there. And after that, he died very young. He died in 1922, aged just 34. He got bronchitis in exile in Portugal, and had respiratory failure there. His son Otto von Habsburg took over, and he lived until 2011. All right, so because of the war, we have a very Americo-centric presentation of music at this point. But we have this is one of the songs of the war. You know, like the Second World War has got loads of great music and media that goes with it. The First World War, it's all kind of propaganda. That's the best way to look at it. It doesn't really go past that. But this is one of the. One of the famous songs of the war, written by a couple of Welsh songwriters, and George Henry Powell and Felix Powell. And it was sent over to America for a show called Her Soldier Boy. So that's why we have a recording of it. And it's by Murray Johnson. It's Pack Up Your Troubles and Your Old Kit Bag and Smile, Smile, Smile. Let's have a listen to that.
Okay.
Private Puss is a funny little conjure with a smile, a funny smile. 5 feet none, he's an awful little dodger with a smile, a sunny smile. Flushed or broke, he'll have his little joke. He can't be suppressed. All the other fellows have to grin when he gets rid of his chest. Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you balloon the puzzle line your bag, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
Well, yeah, I mean, this song, this would be the one song if you were to ask me, you know, like, do you know any First World War songs? This would be the song, just because, you know, I would have learned this at school when I was a kid, you know, perhaps when we were learning about First World War during history or something like that. But I definitely remember learning this song as a child, for sure, so.
It's jingoistic, perhaps.
It's like a bit like keep, and there's a lot of keep calm and carry on in this, isn't there?
Yeah, and you know, people wouldn't put up with that in the real Second World War, would they? So, yeah, but yeah, it's a marching song for going off to war, and yeah, it's A Long Way to Tipperary is the other one.
Oh yeah,
which that's written a little bit before the war though. So, but this one was written at the start of the war, 1915, and yeah, it's a bit too. A bit too positive, considering the slaughter that was going on, I think. Kind of feels a bit distasteful.
No,
now.
Indeed.
It was revived a few years ago. Eliza Doolittle. You know Eliza Doolittle?
Okay.
She's a pop singer. It's like a pop dance version that kind of has that as the chorus.
Interesting.
That's the war. We don't have that much material to cover the war. We will have next time, because the Americans are getting involved.
No, I suppose it would have been interesting to know what the Austro-Hungarians would be listening to in Vienna, and I suppose would have been listening to a lot of waltzes, I suppose. And I don't know what they would have been listening to in Germany or...
It's true, they do like their waltzes, the Viennese.
Yes.
Let's go a bit further afield to Russia. Let's hear what they're doing in Russia. Russia on the cusp of the revolution, of course, there. A very troubled time for Russia indeed. But they are still recording some music. This is a guy called Alexander Vertinsky. A popular Russian Soviet poet, singer, composer, cabaret artist who would continue to be popular into the Soviet era. And this is kind of an emotional ballad. It's called Malenki Krelochik. Malenki is like little, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Krelochik sounds like a diminutive of some sort. This is Alexander Vertinsky.
Где же вы, мой маленький крылочек, мой смуглый принц Сантийских островов, мой маленький китайский колокольчик, капризный как дитя, как песенка без слов, такой беспомощный, как дикий одуванчик, такой изысканный, изящный и простой. соль. Капуст без вас, мой старый балаганчик, как бледен ваш Пьеро, как плачет он порой. Куда же вы ушли, мой маленький крылочек? Мой смуглый принц с Антильских островов, мой маленький китайский колокольчик, капризный, как духи, как песенка без
So I mean, this one I really, 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 really enjoyed this one. It's just got that real, I mean, that sort of passion, I imagine, sort of from, you know, Russian poetry or singing, or it's got that real passion. There's that longing and melancholy, and also I think again, like the, you were talking about, obviously the last track, you know, pack up your troubles and stuff. I mean, it's kind of quite sad to listen to it, because thinking about these guys going into the trenches, you know, singing this song merrily, kind of thing. But again, this kind of thinking about this kind of song, like what's going to happen in Russia now, basically, for the next few decades, is just going to be, you know, there's going to be so much change, and there's going to be suffering, and there's obviously, they're still finishing First World War, and then they're going to have civil wars, and they're going to have all kinds of unimaginable things that are going to happen. And obviously this guy was right there, right at the center. And, you know, obviously he was an artist before the Soviet Union. So luckily he managed to get on the right side of the new regime, on the other side. So I'm glad to know that he had a bit more of a career anyway.
Yeah, he did. He did manage to become a Soviet artist. He's a half Ukrainian as well. And he did have kind of a Ukrainian identity as well. And he, if you can imagine, he had like a Piero kind of thing. He dressed up as like a sad clown. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, you can picture that, I guess, of him performing in a cabaret, that kind of song, with his sad clown makeup.
Yes,
that's what he did. Terrible time for Russia, of course. Yeah.
No, for sure. But I remember sort of recently, I was lucky enough to take the Trans-Siberian Railway from China, a journey that you know very well yourself. So taking the train back from Beijing to Moscow, I bought a little USB drive, which was in the shape of the Trans-Siberian engine, and then on the stick had lots of Russian music, so it was really good to listen to that on the train, sort of looking out the window. And there was a lot of kind of what you might say, you could say is cheesy Russian music, but I actually like it. There's sort of, some of the music had this kind of style, maybe a bit more up-tempo, and there would be some cheesy synthesizer behind it, but it still has that emotion and passion that I still enjoy, you know?
Let's go down to Greece.
Great.
This is... what's happening in Greece in the First World War? Were they involved in the First World War? I guess they were part of the Ottoman Empire at the start of it, and having various revolutions during this time, maybe.
Yes.
I can't say... I wish I knew more about Greece in the First World War. I feel like they're in the middle of getting independence from the Ottomans at this point. And yeah, there's a lot of trouble going on before and after the First World War as well, if I remember correctly.
No, for sure. And they've got, obviously, it's not like sort of the Greece as we know it today suddenly became independent on a particular day, because it was a little bit more messy than that. And also, you know, some islands became independent later, or they joined Greece later. But certainly they were at the middle of that sort of great struggle with the Ottoman Empire as that's breaking up, and then Austro-Hungary and Italy as well, and the British were obviously involved. So yeah, it's a bit messy for sure.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. The music that comes out of Greece over the next 20 or so years is called Rembetika.
Okay.
It's like protest songs, kind of subversive protest songs, like folk music. And this is like an early example of that. And it's by Kyria Kula, and it's called Tsife Teli.
Again, this is another one that I really, really like. There's a theme here, like sort of stuff, stuff from the East, like, you know. But I think it's a very abstract. So I'm interested, like to know more about that instrument. But also, you know, I mean, some of the sounds that I'm getting there, I could sort of almost be listening. Some of the electronic music that I like to listen to may have some essence of that, you know.
Poor production, plus kind of exotic things does. I mean, quite often that doesn't lead to anything, but on occasions those two things kind of just gel together to make something that sounds just like kind of otherworldly and bizarre.
Indeed. It's,
and I think this is one of those cases. The Rembetika music does become more standardized and more kind of normal later on, and it is kind of weird to, it's good to hear it in this kind of early formation where it sounds just still strange, you know.
Fascinating. Yeah, I would never have pictured that as being Greek.
Let's go to South America now. This is a Brazilian guitarist, I think, called Canhoto with Abiso de Rosas.
Nice.
So the sounds of South America there. We are in approaching tango, so we've just kind of got guitar instrumentals and things like that. Proto tango is being gestated at this point, which had become a big thing into the 20s 30s. Not quite as impressed as with the previous two songs, could I say that?
No, I mean, I liked it. It's a sort of, you know, perhaps if I'm in a beautiful square in Europe with my wife, I have a nice meal and like some guys come over, buskers, and some music I quite like to listen to in the evening, maybe. You know, maybe initially be a little bit embarrassed trying to ignore them, and then in the end, giving him a €5 or something. Mm.
It's coming alive. I'm feeling it. Yeah, I can imagine that too. Yeah. But yeah, let's go back to the USA, shall we?
Okay.
So 1916 is notable, I would say, as the last year of really old music. The earliest people go back with trad jazz is the first jazz recording, which is in 1917, which is next year. Mm. However, we have this weird recording from 1916, and this was recorded right at the end of 1916. And it's by Collins and Harlan. And Collins is Arthur Collins, who we've heard previously, the king of the ragtime singers. And it's called That Funny Jazz Band from Dixieland. And jazz is spelled J-A-S here. And yeah, I think maybe just let's first have a listen to it, because it's a bizarre cultural artifact. I have to apologize for the spoken word section in the middle, which is straight out of a minstrel show, but I can't really cuss it out. It is part of the whole context of the recording, so apologies in advance.
Howdy, Sal.
Doggone.
Glad to see you, honey. Hello, gal.
Keep it going.
Got a roll of money, don't you land. On our way, some cafe. With lots of pep and ginger, there's a place.
Oh, boss.
You'll go wild about it, dancing space.
Old heart.
Wouldn't be without it, but if you go, you'll say I know. Just to hear the jazz band play. Oh, honey, dear.
Oh, honey, dear.
I want you to hear.
I want you to hear.
That harmony quiz. When you listen to mad musicians playing rhythm,
everybody dancing with them.
Oh, 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 hold me close in your arms.
Me close in your arms.
I'm in love with your charm. And a funny jazz band from Dixieland. Different from the generality of bands.
In what particularity, Henry?
Oh, in many ways, Mandy. Now, for instance...
Lordy, lordy, is that one of the ways?
Mm-hmm. And another is,
Is there any more, Henry?
Oh, yes. And it goes something like,
Well, I must say, Henry, your explanation am lucidiously comprehensible.
And does you like the jazz band, Mandy?
I sure do.
Then we'll sing some more. Come on, Sal.
Doggone.
Now I guess we're stepping. Come on, gal.
Come on.
Put a lot of pep and we won't stop till we drop. Oh, pop. We're going to do some dancing. You're so sweet.
Oh, Bill.
I'm a little flurried. Hurt your feet?
Be still.
Yes, I'm a little hurried. Cause when I hear that music quit, poor old people not behave. Oh, honey dear.
Oh, honey dear.
I want you to hear.
I want you to hear.
That harmony quit.
Oh, so quit.
When you listen to mad musicians playing rhythm,
everybody dancing with them.
Oh, hold me close in your arms.
Close in your arms.
I'm in love with your charm. And the funny jazz band from Dixieland. I want you to
First impressions of that. I've got a lot to say about this, but I want to hear what you think about it first.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting, you know, you're talking about it being the sort of the last of the old, you know, sort of prehistory of music, but at the same time, on one level, it's very self-aware that obviously that there is this new music that's occurring, and that this is you know, that there's this new genre of music that's very different and distinct, and it has its own unique characteristics, and it's exciting, and there's change happening. So on the one hand, it's quite a good sort of segue, really, from one era to the other.
Yeah, there is a buzz developing about this new music, and it's from New Orleans. It's been around maybe like 10 years or so at this point, but no one's been going down there recording it. It's I'm reading this book called Subversive Sounds right now about the atmosphere in New Orleans at that time, which was very restricted and repressed compared to like 20 years before in the same city. And it kind of leaked out of there, and there were these bands from New Orleans going playing up the Mississippi River, and then in Chicago, and then New York, and next year in 1917 we're going to have them actually making records. So there was obviously kind of a buzz about it, but what jazz meant is another question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, what they understood by it, because it's reflected in the music in the first few years. It's like jazz is, they've got an idea, jazz is, it's like normal music but like more crazy and wacky. That's the kind of impression that people have of it, first of all. And you can think when rock and roll came along, when punk music came along, you kind of have outsiders, like music industry outsiders, that going like, oh, that's just not like normal music but a bit more like this or a bit more like that. And early jazz does have this kind of novelty music feel to it,
and like then also especially skiffle and
costumes,
skiffle, yeah, and things like that.
Yeah, they're just, it's a novelty music at the time. That every genre starts out as a novelty, and we'll hear the decent music coming from New Orleans and elsewhere in the 1920s, and the early jazz songs. There's some really good stuff, but it is you can hear in the instrumental breaks there. It does sound kind of like the first jazz recordings, just briefly there, but it's also that they're talking about how wild and crazy, and how you'll be freaked out by all the bizarre noises going on. That's the calling card of jazz, as far as they're concerned.
But that sounds like that's where the party's at, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. But it does sound very much like a novelty that's going to be around for a couple of years, which is very much not what it was, you know. And Arthur Collins is an interesting guy. Like I say, I called him the Edwardian Elvis, because he's taking all these things in, like, from like black culture and presenting it to like a white audience.
Appropriating.
That's his USP there. And they'll make a few like jazz related things later on, but he's very much a creature of the 19th century, you know. And him making the first song that mentions jazz is I can't think of anything similar to it. It's like if the first acid house recording was made by like a middle of the road singer like Engelbert Humperdinck from the 60s. can you imagine?
Yeah.
it's like that. It's such a bizarre thing to be the case. But yeah,
he's a teddy boy. Is he the first teddy boy? I don't know if he's an Edwardian.
I didn't talk about Byron G. Harlan, who's his partner on this duet, who he sang with a lot, and they were both big portly Edwardian gentlemen. Yeah, they were called the 10-ton duo sometimes.
Okay.
And Byron G. Harlan does the high pitched lady voice, which I don't know. I would be embarrassed if I were him, but he was getting by.
Yeah,
that was his career.
Yes,
you know, yeah. You can't take that away from him. It's an exciting time, 1916, despite all the unpleasantness happening in Europe. Jazz is about to break out and it's going to be a revolution, and you can kind of hear it's happening there. And in a minute we'll hear something else which is new, which is country folk music, as to play out with. So there's a whole revolution going on in music, which as far as this project of mine, Centuries of Sound, starts in 1853, and it's been a long time. I'll say that. It's been a long time before something's really come along, and I guess solid recordings from 1889 onwards, really. So it's been a long time. It's been like 30 years of waiting for something big to come along, and finally it's here. So it's exciting.
Yeah.
Centuries of Sound on Cambridge 105 Radio.
You've been listening to Centuries of Sound on Cambridge 105 Radio. I've been James Errington, and I've been joined today by
John Ashton.
And if you're interested in finding out more about Centuries of Sound, I make a mix for every year of recorded sound, and I've got to 1925 so far. You can find me by coming to centuriesofsound.com, or just searching for Centuries of Sound wherever you get podcasts. Or if you want to email me about any clarifications, comments, concerns, anything like that, you can email me at james@centuriesofsound.com. So what did you make, John, overall of the music of 1916? Was it to your expectation?
Well, I feel lucky because, I have enjoyed some of your earlier episodes, and I'm just glad. Obviously, it sounds like 1917 is going to be even more exciting, but I'm just glad I got like 1916 and not sort of 1884 or something like that, because no, there were some genuine gems in there. Obviously, there's plenty of sort of brass band and marching band and that kind of stuff, which is not necessarily my cup of tea, but yeah, some really beautiful music, some terrific singers, and yeah, really feeling at a crossroads in many ways.
Yeah. Like the Blazing Squad.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us, everybody. We're going to play out with Don Richardson, an American fiddler, playing the old folk tune, Arkansas Traveller. So thank you for listening to Centuries of Sound today. Good night. Thank you.
This radio program was originally broadcast on the 20th of June 2020 and features guest John Ashley. Get a host of bonus features like this and full mixes as podcasts by signing up as a supporter at patreon.com/centuriesofsound.